Hello and welcome to the Verity Podcast for Saturday, March 30th, 2024. We're the only podcast that keeps on separating the fact from the narrative spin. I'm Adam Clark.
And I'm Eric Steiner. Here's a look at today's top stories. The International Court of Justice orders Israel to address Gaza's famine.
While Israel agrees to send a delegation to Egypt and Qatar for Gaza talks.
Russia's UN veto ends the body's monitoring of nuclear sanctions.
Greece's government survives a no-confidence vote over a deadly 2023 train crash.
Georgia's legislature passes a sweeping elections bill.
Former Presidents Obama and Clinton help Joe Biden raise $25 million at a New York fundraiser.
Representative James Comer wants Joe Biden to testify in the president's impeachment trial.
A Texas woman who was sentenced to prison for voter fraud is acquitted.
45 are killed in a tragic bus plunge in South Africa.
And a new report says the world wasted 1 billion meals a day in 2022.
In our top story, the ICJ orders Israel to address the famine in Gaza. The facts are agreed upon by BBC News, Al Jazeera, The Guardian, and NPR Online News. The UN's top court, the International Court of Justice, or ICJ, voted unanimously Thursday to order Israel to act without delay to enable the delivery of aid and food to Gaza. It said, quote, Palestinians in Gaza are no longer facing only a risk of famine, but that famine is setting in. It noted that 31 Palestinians, 27 of them children, had already died of malnutrition and dehydration in Gaza. The legally binding decision orders Israel to take, quote, all necessary and effective measures in full cooperation with the United Nations to provide aid, including food, water, fuel, and medical supplies. The emergency measure coincides with an ICJ complaint filed by South Africa against Israel, which accuses Israel of committing genocide in Gaza. Israel has vehemently denied such allegations. While the ICJ could take years to rule on South Africa's wider case, the court in January found it plausible that Israel had violated the Genocide Convention and ordered Israel to take a series of provisional measures. Those measures, which Israel is still legally obligated to follow alongside new orders, called on the state not to commit any of the acts prohibited by the convention, as well as to do everything within its power to prevent and punish those involved with inciting genocide.
Thank you, Eric, for the facts on our first story today. I'm going to start our first round of narrative spins with a pro-Palestine narrative, and it's provided by BBC News. After months of UN warnings about the humanitarian situation in Gaza, Israel has not acted to facilitate the entry of much-needed aid. Children are now dying of malnutrition, and the UN now finds it plausible that Israel is using man-made famine as an act of war. Palestinians are currently only receiving aid dropped from planes, which is the most inefficient way to deliver supplies. Israel must act immediately to address this suffering.
And we follow that up with a pro-Israel narrative coming from Israel Defense Forces. Israel and its military are committed to complying with international law, delivering hundreds of thousands of tons of food and tens of thousands of tons of water, among several other packages of supplies. While aid convoys have to be checked for weapons that might be delivered to Hamas, Israel has worked tirelessly to quickly screen these deliveries and bring them through Egypt and safely into Gaza.
The nerds have an opinion on our first story today. They think that there's a 50% chance that Israel will lift the blockade on electricity, food, gasoline, and medicine in Gaza by June of 2024. A delegation to Egypt and Qatar for Gaza truce talks. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Reuters, Jerusalem Post, Al Jazeera, The Times of Israel, and The New York Times. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced on Friday that after speaking with the heads of the country's top intelligence agencies, he would send a delegation to Egypt and Qatar to continue negotiations to secure the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza in exchange for a temporary truce and the release of Palestinian prisoners. Negotiations, which reportedly made little progress this week, come as the U.S. and Israel increasingly focus on Gaza's post-war future. Israeli media reported on Friday that War Cabinet member Gadi Eisenkot presented a proposal stressing the need to dismantle Hamas, reach a hostage deal, and establish a so-called Palestinian entity to run the Strip's civil affairs. Israeli plans for Gaza's future have usually either ignored or sidelined the Palestinian Authority, or the PA, which partially runs the West Bank, creating tension with the U.S., as it has said it would like a revitalized PA to run Gaza. After facing U.S. and international pressure, the PA announced on Thursday that it had formed a new cabinet. Regardless of plans for after the war, a U.S. official said that most of the Gaza Strip faces a serious risk of famine, adding that famine is already, quote, quite possibly present in parts of northern Gaza. The official stressed the need to get food into northern Gaza and said that though aid distribution has improved, it is not yet enough. Israel has blamed aid agencies for the worsening humanitarian situation, saying that the problem has been the amount of aid being delivered, not Israel's security checks. On Friday, in response to a recent International Court of Justice order, Israel said it is committed to fulfilling its humanitarian obligations. Meanwhile, the tensions on the Lebanese border escalated this week, with heavy exchanges of fire across the border. Israel Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said on Friday that Israel will expand its campaign against Hezbollah, adding that Israel will reach Beirut, Damascus, and, quote, more distant places.
Adam, thanks for that update. We've got a few spins. We start with the pro-establishment narrative coming from Voice of America. Though it must go through many changes beforehand, the only viable Palestinian political entity capable of governing Gaza after the war is the PA. Everyone can agree that the PA has many issues that must be urgently fixed, namely its corruption and the weakness of its leadership. Nonetheless, Israel cannot reoccupy the Gaza Strip, as this is both logistically and morally out of the question, and a revitalized PA will have to be created to take over Gaza's civil administration at the very least.
Eric, I'm going to counter that with a pro-Israel narrative that's provided by the Jewish News Syndicate. Though the U.S. may believe that it can force the PA to, quote, reform, the reality is the PA is simply not a partner for peace. Like Hamas, the PA supports the destruction of Israel, teaches Palestinians to hate, and lacks democratic legitimacy. The PA would be incapable of demilitarizing Gaza or de-radicalizing its population, meaning that the chance that an attack like October 7th could happen again remains. Indeed, Israel may as well let Hamas stay in power if it is truly considering allowing the PA to take over Gaza the day after the war.
We continue the spins with the pro-Palestine narrative coming from Italy East Eye. U.S. President Joe Biden must realize what Israel and Netanyahu plan to do with Gaza after the war. Change the facts on the ground so that Palestinians cannot return and Gaza's beachfront real estate be transformed into luxurious Israeli settlements. At best, Biden is blind to what Israel's true desires are, and, at worst, fully complicit in Gaza's ethnic cleansing. Israeli officials continue to openly say what they want to do with Gaza and the Palestinian people, yet all the U.S. can do is express concern. These crimes must end.
Eric, the spin's going to continue, and Al-Mayadeen is going to provide us with a narrative D. Hezbollah and the regional resistance will only end their attacks when Israel's war in Gaza ends and it withdraws its forces. Indeed, the resistance's primary goal is to end the war in Gaza, not start a far larger regional war. Foreign powers believe they can dictate to Hezbollah how it deals with Israel's aggression and impose concessions regarding the status of Lebanon's southern border. However, Hezbollah has the leverage needed to ensure that Lebanon gains if any agreement is reached.
All right, we're going to wrap it up with a nerd narrative from Metaculus saying there's a 5% chance that the Palestinian Authority, or Fatah, will have de facto power in the Gaza Strip on January 1st, 2025. In our next story, Russia's veto ends the UN monitoring of North Korea's nuclear sanctions. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Al Jazeera, BBC News, Associated Press, Sky News, and Forbes. Russia on Thursday vetoed the renewal of a UN panel that monitors North Korea's compliance with sanctions levied on the North's nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs. While the 2006 sanctions remain in place, the veto disbands the panel, which was probing Russia's alleged purchase of North Korean arms for use against Ukraine. The panel's mandate will now end April 30th. 13 members of the 15-member Security Council voted to renew the panel, while China abstained. Russia and North Korea have denied allegations of a weapons transfer, even as they in 2023 expressed their intent to strengthen their military ties. Several nations, including the U.S., France, and Ukraine, criticized Russia's veto, terming it a, quote, reckless action and a guilty plea.
Thank you, Eric. Our spins are going to begin with an anti-Russia narrative provided by Guardian. Russia's veto is a clear case of collusion. It sparks concerns over nuclear proliferation and sanctions evasion. Although it safeguards Russia's interests, it dismisses concerns for the safety of the world should North Korea violate the sanctions. An axis between Pyongyang and Moscow is something the global community must be wary of.
And the pro-Russia narrative comes from the Times of India. This panel needs to end because it's no longer unbiased and instead leans toward the whims and opinions of Western countries. These same Western nations have decided to single out Russia for its opposition, despite China abstaining, which effectively was a second vote to veto.
Eric, the nerds think that there's a 33% chance of Russian territory being reduced by at least 1% before January 1st of 2040.
And that's according to the Metaculous Prediction Community.
Community!
Community!
The community!
News out of Greece, where the government survives a no-confidence vote over the train crash. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Associated Press, Keep Talking Greece, E. Kathy Marini, Dovima, Bloomberg, and Politico. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis's conservative government defeated on Thursday, 159 to 141, a no-confidence vote tabled by opposition parties over the handling of an investigation into the country's deadliest rail crash. Given that such a motion has to be approved by an absolute majority in the 300-seat parliament, some New Democracy lawmakers would have to support the motion or at least abstain for it to pass. While the government survived the no-confidence vote, two ministers resigned after an opposition leader revealed that they had drinks on Sunday night with a businessman that the government claimed to be behind the motion. The vote was put forward after the weekly Tavima published on Sunday a front-page story about doctored audio tapes leaked to the press in the wake of the Tempe train disaster. 57 people, mostly students, died and some 80 others were injured on February of 2023 after a passenger train that departed from Athens to Thessaloniki crashed with a goods train near Larissa. According to separate polls, an overwhelmingly majority of Greeks claim that neither the judicial nor the political establishment had ensured justice after the tragedy, as well as that a cover-up is likely to have taken place.
Thank you, Adam. The first spin is Narrative A, and it's coming from Courthouse News. The opposition knew beforehand that this motion was likely to fail to remove the government, as New Democracy holds an absolute majority in parliament, so the goal here was to put the prime minister and his allies in a position they wanted to avoid. Legal troubles have just started, and most Greeks now deeply distrust them.
There's a Narrative B spin provided by Greek City Times. 1 year after the Tempe train tragedy, Greek must remain united to find the truth, hold those responsible accountable, and prevent similar disasters in the future. That's why this failed no-confidence motion could do no good for the country. It's time to let justice work with due diligence in a timely manner.
Let's check in with the nerd herd once again from Metaculous. They say there's a 1% chance that Greece will experience a successful coup d'etat before 2040. Turning our attention back to the U.S. as the Georgia legislature passes a sweeping elections bill. Here are the facts as agreed upon by NPR Online News, The Guardian, NBC, and Fox 5 Atlanta. The Republican-majority Georgia state legislature Thursday passed Senate Bill 189, covering several election-related issues. It now goes to Republican Governor Brian Kemp's office for his signature or veto. The bill, which passed 101-73 in the House and 33-22 in the Senate, would allow any presidential candidate who is qualified in at least 20 other states to be on the ballot in Georgia. In addition, residents would be allowed to challenge voter registration for several reasons, including a subsequent registration in another state, using a different address for a homestead tax exemption, or registering with a non-residential address. Another provision would require to report the results of absentee ballots within 1 hour of polls closing. Counties would also be allowed to issue paper ballots in districts with fewer than 5,000 people. residents with no permanent address would be required to register with the address of the registrar of the county in which they reside. They are currently allowed to register using shelters or government offices. Ballot counters would also be required to use the physical printed text to count votes rather than barcode scanners, as well as print high-resolution ballots.
Thank you, Eric. And with a politically motivated story like this, of course, we're going to have some political spins. The Republicans are going to have their say, and PJ Media is going to say it for them. Despite what Democrats may say, this common sense bill will prevent dead people from voting and restrict those who are alive from voting twice. President Biden's margin of victory in the state in 2020 was extremely small, so it's important to ensure that 2024 and every election is free and fair.
We follow that with a Democratic narrative coming from ACLU of Georgia. Republicans know this is a voter suppression bill, and that's why they rushed it through before the close of the legislative session and before the opposition could read it. If it becomes law, it will make it more difficult for those from marginalized communities to have their voices heard.
Oh, the nerds think that there's a 55% chance that the Republican nominee for president in the 2024 election will win Georgia.
And that's according to the meticulous prediction community.
Barack Obama and Bill Clinton helped President Biden raise $25 million at a New York fundraiser. Here are the facts as agreed upon by U.S. News & World Report, CBS, Voice of America, BBC News, Associated Press, and the New York Post. Former Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama joined their Democratic successor, President Joe Biden, at a campaign fundraiser in New York on Thursday, which reportedly raised more than $25 million for Biden's re-election campaign. The fundraiser, hosted by actress Mindy Kaling, took place at Radio City Music Hall. First Lady Jill Biden delivered remarks during the event, which featured performances by musical guests including Queen Latifah and Lea Michele. Obama commended Biden, stating, "That's the kind of president I want," while Clinton asked voters to stay with what works. The tickets were reportedly priced between $225 and $500,000, while guests paid $100,000 to have a photo taken with the three presidents by celebrity photographer Annie Leibovitz. At the end of February, Biden had $155 million in cash on hand, compared with the presumptive Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump's $37 million, backed by the Save America Political Action Committee. Though Trump's campaign admits that Biden will still have a financial advantage, Trump is reportedly planning a South Florida fundraiser next week that it is speculated could raise up to $33 million, closing the gap.
Adam, thanks for the facts. The first spin is a Democratic narrative coming from Washington Post. Momentum is swinging the Biden campaign's direction, and the incumbent has all hands on deck as he is ramping up his re-election bid. President Clinton and Obama both soared to victory twice and will look to bring that same magic to President Biden. Thursday's fundraiser is a sign of power and strength for the Biden-Harris campaign, which already has a major cash advantage over Donald Trump. Big-time donors and celebrities aren't abandoning the president, and the Democrats' organization and infrastructural advantage will lead Biden to victory in November.
The Daily Caller is going to counter that, Eric, with a Republican narrative. While Biden was in New York for an elaborate fundraiser, Donald Trump visited the state to attend the funeral of a fallen police officer. While the elite class believes that money is all that matters in electoral politics, Trump is showing that grassroots support is far more important. It's no surprise that out-of-touch celebrities and wealthy elites are going all out for Biden. Meanwhile, Trump has made the GOP into the party for the working class. No amount of money could buy Biden the support and enthusiasm that the nation has for Trump.
And the nerds from Metaculus say there's a 50% chance that Joe Biden will be elected to be U.S. president in 2024. Comer wants Biden to testify in the House impeachment probe. The facts are agreed upon by Associated Press, ABC News, UPI, and CBS. Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, chair of the U.S. House Oversight Committee, Thursday sent a letter to President Joe Biden inviting him to publicly testify before the chamber as part of the Republican-led impeachment inquiry. So far, the inquiry into alleged access trading with foreign entities by the president and his son Hunter's businesses hasn't uncovered any evidence of wrongdoing by the elder Biden while the former U.S. senator and vice president was in public office. Comer claimed there's a, quote, yawning gap between Biden's public comments and what the committee has learned. By testifying, Comer further claimed Biden could explain under oath his involvement in his family's sources of income and the means it has used to generate it. This comes 1 week after two former business associates of Hunter Biden, Tony Bobulinski and Jason Galanis, and Ukrainian businessman Lev Parnas provided the House with contradictory testimony about the Bidens. There's precedent for a president testifying before Congress, most recently President Gerald Ford in 1974. But a White House spokesperson called the Comer's letter a, quote, sad stunt at the end of a dead impeachment.
Thank you, Eric. We're going to start the spins with the Democratic narrative. It's provided by Huffington Post. This letter is just a continuation of the Republicans' kangaroo court disguised as an impeachment inquiry. Republicans have hit a dead end, so they've desperately created a spectacle by calling the president to testify about something completely fabricated. If Republicans had anything on Biden, they'd vote to upgrade this inquiry into a full-scale impeachment, but they haven't.
And we follow that up with the Washington Times and their Republican narrative. Upgrading this from an inquiry to a full-scale impeachment would be useless because it would die in the Democratic majority Senate. It's more important to keep accumulating evidence against Biden and refer the case to the Justice Department to hold the president accountable. If Biden did nothing wrong, he should clear up any discrepancies by testifying in Congress.
Well, the nerds think there's a 16% chance that Biden will be impeached by the House of Representatives.
And that's according to the Metaculous Prediction Community.
A woman sentenced for voter fraud in Texas has been acquitted. Here are the facts as agreed upon by Guardian, CNN, NPR Online News, New York Times, and The Hill. A Texas appeals court has thrown out a 5-year prison sentence that was handed down to a Texas woman, Crystal Mason, over casting an ineligible ballot in the 2016 election. Mason was serving the end of a tax felony sentence on probation, but she claimed she didn't know she was ineligible to vote while serving the sentence. Prosecutors argued that the necessary information was included on the ballot. Since she wasn't on the voter registry at the time, she filled out a provisional ballot, though it was later rejected and never counted. During her appeals process in 2020, Texas's Second Court of Criminal Appeals ruled that whether she was aware or not was irrelevant to the prosecution. After the ruling, the state's highest appeals court ordered the lower court to review the case again and, quote, evaluate the sufficiency of the evidence under the correct interpretation of the statute. The case has relied upon testimony from the poll worker who reviewed the affidavit signed by Mason regarding information about felons. The court's final ruling said there wasn't enough evidence to prove she, quote, actually realized she couldn't vote.
Thanks, Adam. The first spin for this story is a Democratic narrative coming from MSNBC. This is a win for voting rights, particularly for Black voters whom Republican-led states wish to make voting harder. Several Republicans have been convicted of far more egregious voter fraud, including a Georgia GOP vice chairman who voted 9 times. But unlike Mason, he was given no prison sentence and only a $5,000 fine. The party that claims to care about voter fraud is letting its own members off the hook while giving criminals from their team a slap on the wrist.
Well, the Republicans have something to say about that, and Town Hall's going to say it. While Democrats will try and spin this into a civil rights issue, the truth is that Ms. Mason only completed 3 of her 5 years in prison, the following 2 of which she was still a convicted felon and couldn't vote. Mason, who upon her release swore not to lie about her felon status, was part of a growing problem in Texas, which continued years later when the state prosecuted over 30 cases in 2018.
Checking in with the nerds again from Metaculous, they say there's a 10% chance a state will officially submit results to the Electoral College that are different from the projected winner of that state in the 2024 presidential election. Tragic news as 45 have been killed after a South Africa bus crash. And here are the facts as agreed upon by UFH and the World Construction Network. On Thursday, 45 people were killed in South Africa after a bus carrying worshippers to an Easter weekend celebration crashed into a bridge, plunged down a mountain pass, and burst into flames, killing everyone except a seriously injured 8-year-old girl. The bus was traveling from Gaborone, Botswana's capital, to a popular Easter festival in Moria in the northern Limpopo province. However, the vehicle crashed on a bridge in a mountainous area near Mamalakala, descending 164 feet or 50 meters into a ravine before catching fire. A South Africa Department of Transport spokesperson said the sole survivor is currently in stable condition at a hospital, adding that she was likely ejected out of the bus when it hit the bridge. Authorities are investigating the cause of the crash, though there's speculation that the driver lost control of the bus. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa said all the victims were from Botswana, and he contacted the country's leader to offer his condolences and help. Meanwhile, Transport Minister Sindisiwe Chikunga said the government will repatriate the bodies to Botswana. South Africa has some of the world's highest road fatality rates in the world, and the country had over 12,000 traffic deaths in 2022, which the Automobile Association of South Africa called a, quote, national crisis. The group has also urged the government to invest more in road safety.
Eric, thank you for the facts on that tragic story. We're going to start our spins with a narrative A provided by UFH. South Africa has failed to adequately invest in road safety, leading to a national crisis and major tragedies. Much of the country's roads, especially in rural areas, are accidents waiting to happen, so the government must immediately invest in major infrastructure improvements.
And narrative B comes from World Construction Network. South Africa is doing its best to allocate its financial resources in the most effective way. In 2024, the government is prioritizing infrastructure and transportation, building up roads and other public infrastructure. However, it will take some time for South Africa to achieve its ambitious infrastructure goals, which will help to prevent tragic accidents in the future.
And the nerds at Metaculus believe that there's a 50% chance that South Africa's GDP per capita will be more than $12,300 in 2030. Our final story is the result of a report that the world wasted 1 billion meals a day in 2022. Here are the facts as agreed upon by CNBC TV Channel 18, Al Jazeera, CNN, Guardian, and ABC News. According to the UN's latest Food Waste Index report, households globally wasted 1 billion meals a day in 2022, or about 20% of the world's food output, at a time when approximately 800 million people were in need of food assistance. The report found that the annual cost of food loss and waste, which generated between 8% and 10% of worldwide greenhouse gas emissions, is estimated to be worth over $1 trillion. Even though food loss and waste emit approximately 5 times more than aviation emissions, only 21 governments have incorporated it in their climate strategy. More food is wasted in warmer regions where food spoils faster due to higher temperatures and lack of appropriate refrigeration. The findings also suggest that rural communities waste less than urban communities in middle-income nations, while an individual typically wastes roughly 79 kilos or 174 pounds of food yearly.
Thanks, Adam. The first spin is Narrative A coming from UN Environment. There's a tremendous systemic global issue in the world when a third of all food is wasted in production, a third of the population suffers from food insecurity, and hundreds of millions more go hungry. Food waste also drives climate change, making it one of the hidden emitters. Food should be in people's stomachs, not in landfills.
That's going to continue with a narrative B provided by Jason Lusk. Such studies about food waste should be treated with caution. The findings are sometimes overestimated, since some food waste may be used productively, such as animal feed and compost, and the value of wasted food is frequently priced at the retail level. Better defining context and definitions are vital in the global waste discourse.
And the nerds from Metaculus have one more narrative. They say there's a 50% chance that the first fully automated McDonald's will open in the United States by January of the year 2030. Thanks for listening to the Verity Podcast for Saturday, March 30th, 2024.
Each day we use machine learning to read about 5,000 articles from about 100 newspapers and figure out which ones are about the same stories. For each major story, our editorial team then extracts both the key facts that all articles agree on and the key narratives where the articles differ.
Find out more at Verity.news, and you can download the Verity app on the Apple App Store or Google Play. For Adam Clark, I'm Eric Steiner, inviting you to join us next time on the Verity Podcast.
Have a happy Easter, everyone.
You too, Adam. It's so pleasing to speak with you again.
Oh, thank you, Eric. I always have such a good time with you.
It is a ball. Thank you.
You're welcome.